Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll and the only home of the patented Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you from London. I'm actually literally watching Wimbledon. And guess what? Check this out. Number one rated Andy Murray. You know what time he goes to bed? 10-ish. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Nice. I like how Duff used a little bit of an English twinge there for that joke since he's in London. Thanks to Duff for bringing the last every Friday and bringing the music all summer long with Guns N' Roses. The stadium tour is rolling. Go see it if you can. Tickets and information at gunsandroses.com. They're playing Friday and Saturday at Twickenham Stadium in London. I was talking to Duff today, and he's very excited to play this weekend for all of the UK fans. And I'm headed to the UK this weekend as well to do the Jericho Chronicles, telling stories and answering your questions. July 4th, we're in Glasgow at SWG. We're going to be talking about AEW. Taking your questions and answers as well. July 5th in Belfast, we're going to be talking about all of my WrestleMania experiences at the Limelight. And July 6th at London in the Grand, we are going to be talking about my greatest matches. And of course, once again, taking all your questions, giving some answers. There are still tickets available at itrtix.com and a few VIP packages left as well. They sold out. We opened up some more. I think they're all going to go. So if you want to meet me and say hi in person, go to itrtix.com. All right, today, Pride Month is ending, and I've got Anthony Bowens here, one half of the acclaimed tag team at AEW and son of Talk is Jericho alumni Sandy Vigilante. Sandy's the guy who's on the show recently talking about hockey fights. He was obsessed with hockey fights. It's a great episode. Go check that out if you haven't had a chance. But Anthony is here today and shares what it was like growing up with his dad and the cool hockey memorabilia he has because of it. He talks about the games he went to and what it was like in his house with dozens of TVs and VCRs constantly taping hockey fights. And of course, Anthony talks all about his wrestling career from his early days to his WWE tryouts, that's plural, more than one, to signing with AEW finally. Great stories about meeting Max Caster for the first time as they're going to meet Tony Khan to become a tag team, the acclaimed. Their first match as a team, developing their characters. He also talks about what inspired their music videos. They did one on me. The scissor greeting and their friendship with the Gun Club. We go over some of their high-profile matches, like the one with MJF and I, and their main event match on Dynamite against the Young Bucks that kind of changed their careers and their lives. Anthony also talks candidly about being a gay wrestler and what it was like early in his career, what finally inspired him to come out. He talks about how many things have changed for the better, the support he received from his family, friends, and coworkers, and how much AEW's inclusivity means to him. He's also got some words of encouragement for anyone else going through the same thing. He's a great guy, very inspirational. Here we go, Anthony Bowens, right here on Talk is Jericho, starting now. So one of the biggest hit shows that I've done over the last few months involves one Anthony Bowen's father, Sandy, with the NHL fights. Now, the thing I wanted to ask you before we get started on your story is, how was that for you growing up? Because I had so much feedback from people going, this guy is great, and he's completely off his rocker, and like, he fights referees that broke up fights and that whole thing. So how was that for you as a kid?
It was fun. I found myself in a lot of, I guess, not NHL, AHL, ECHL, all those leagues, a lot of those locker rooms as a kid. He would always take me up to all these games. He'd go in and cases upon cases of videotapes from all these teams, and he'd go home and edit them off. We had like, I want to say 12 TVs all hooked up to DirecTV satellite dishes going every single night, taping stuff. I would get the box scores. He'd edit all the hockey fights, and then he'd give all the tapes back. It was a whole process, but it was cool. I had a lot of fun. I tried to do it myself with there was this video game. I think it was NHL 01 on PlayStation 2. Mm-hmm. And I'd have a fight in the video game, and I would pop in a VHS tape, and I would tape all the video game fights, and just I could be like my dad. It was crazy, but it was fun. I got a lot of memorabilia out of it too. My whole closet's full of game used hockey sticks, Gretzky, Messier.
Because he had the connections, hockey. All the guys knew him, right?
He didn't do this for money. He just loved it. So when they would offer him stuff, he'd be like, "I don't want money. Just give me, you know, a stick for my for Anthony." So I made out.
Did you ever play hockey at all?
No, I only played baseball. Okay. Hockey really never. I did street hockey, like with my friends, but nothing organized. It was always just baseball and wrestling for me.
So then, how did you get into wrestling? Was that, were you a huge fan as a kid?
Yeah, so I got into wrestling in '97. Sting was the first thing I saw. It was the vignettes for him and Hogan for Starrcade '97, the one where he's like in a. Like in a warehouse, it's raining, like steps on Hogan's face or something. Like,
this Crow Sting, right?
Crow Sting, yeah. I was like, this is cool. And then he's the really one that got me into it. And then I came home one day and there was a VHS tape for WrestleMania 14. My dad dropped off for me. And that's when the super fandom like came in. It was either WWE and WCW every single week.
So you were a fan basically your whole life then,
Whole life. Yeah. So, since I was 6 years old.
So it's interesting to me, we'll talk about your whole career, because like I said, there's so much cool stuff to talk about. We have some great stories as ourselves. But one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was, it's Pride Month, obviously, and I watched your video that you did, because during the show, we show videos from LGBTQ.
Yes.
As you led me along there. And it's cool, because in this day and age, so I've been wrestling for, you know, since the freaking 1600s, but just to see how the attitude on gay men and gay women has changed in wrestling over the years. And you had a really interesting comment, which kind of really spurred why I wanted to talk to you, is that you said you never thought, and I'm paraphrasing this, I'm probably getting it wrong.
Sure.
You never thought you could actually get into the business because of your sexual orientation or something. Is that kind of what you said in that video?
Yeah, I never really... There were a lot of thoughts that were going through my head at one point, if I'd ever be successful in the business. Like I had already started. I started wrestling in 2012, and by that point, I'd been out to just my friends at that point. And there wasn't really that many out athletes. I think Darren Young was the only guy that was like actively out as a professional wrestler. So there didn't really seem to be any hope for me if I came out to be successful in the business. So that was something that scared the hell out of me for a very long time. So... And that was actually one of the biggest things that kept me in the closet for a long time, because my friends knew, and then my parents eventually knew, and everybody was super supportive. Everybody was super helpful and helped me, you know, become comfortable with myself. But it was just the wrestling aspect of things that, you know, there's so many unknowns. Like, would fans turn on me? Would I have to start defending myself in the ring because people might not, you know, like my quote unquote lifestyle? There were so many different thoughts that was running through my head. So I had no idea. Like, am I wasting my time, basically, because, you know, I'm bumping for nothing.
Right, yeah, bumping for nothing. But the thing is, too, that was interesting, around that time frame, there was, like, this is something that's so bad in wrestling, which probably happens in a lot of stuff, but wrestling was kind of the last, are one of the last outposts in like, okay, if you're gay, then we have to do the storyline where you are married, gay marriage, Billy and Chuck, or you are a boy George, like Chris Canyon. That, you know, and then we had Gorgeous George, and we had Adrian Adonis, and we had Adrian Street, and you know, same thing. If you were Japanese, you'd have to come to the ring with some Japanese mandolin and throw salt in people's eyes, and it was still very prevalent in the 2010s when you started, because I think Billy and Chuck was probably, was it around that time? Was it earlier?
I think there were a little bit earlier.
A little bit earlier.
That might have been like 04.
Okay, gotcha. But when you see this as a gay man, do you watch this and go like, oh, is this my fate? Or that kind of, did it kind of discourage you? Or did it bother you? How was that?
Well, in the Billy and Chuck time, I was still pretty young then. I didn't really have any inkling of anything until, I want to say, maybe about midway through high school, which was like 07, around that time period. But yeah, there wasn't really that much representation out there, which is why I think everything is, having a diverse roster like we have is so important, because there's a little bit of,
very much so, yeah,
of everything. You know, you got myself, you got Sonny, you got Nyla. So there's a
Mercedes.
Lot of Mercedes, yeah. Diamante, Layla. So there's a lot of different people on the roster and stories that people can kind of relate to, which I think is pretty cool now. And then even on the independents, like, we've gotten to the point where there's shows with all LGBTQ talent, which is unheard of,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I think we're moving in the right direction. You know, there's still, you know, work to be done, but it's a lot more positive now in the industry than it is like when I started.
So when you first started though, how long did you kind of keep it to yourself? Because you said you were kind of worried about like what kind of judgments will I have against me as a wrestler.
Yeah, so I started in 2012, and then I eventually came out in January of 17. So what happened with that was I met my boyfriend, Michael, in May of 16.
We met him just a few weeks ago, right?
Yes, you met him in L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
And we dated secretly for about 6 months, which I feel really, really guilty about. But I didn't really feel like it was my time yet to come out. So I asked him just to bear with me, which, you know, to his credit, he liked me enough that he did. And there was times where it did suck, especially for him, because, you know, he wants to show his boyfriend around and to his friends.
You kiss at the restaurant or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So that was a bit hard. And he always wanted to start a YouTube channel. And he's like, let's just make this fun, like, YouTube video together. And I was like, nope. that's not happening. Again, I promise you this won't be a forever thing. I just need to feel ready. And I saw how much that, like, it bothered him, and rightfully so. So I was like, no, screw it. No one's going to see this. You have like 3 subscribers. Let's make the video. So it was something called the Laughing Challenge, where you watch like a funny video, like different clips, and you put water in your mouth and you lose if you can't hold the laughter. You spit the water. Very silly. We made it. Didn't think anything of it. And then a couple months later, my buddy Damien, who was one of my friends in the business at the time, he texted me. He was like, dude, you know, why didn't you tell me? And my stomach sank. And I knew what he was talking about, but I played dumb. I was like, you know,
what do you mean?
Yeah, what the hell does this mean? He goes, dude, like, we saw the video. No one cares. We all love you. You're a great worker. We just wish you would have told us. And at that point, I was like, I had the support of my best friends. I had the support of my family, and my wrestling friends support me as well. Like, what am I kind of waiting for here? And I have this great relationship with Michael that I'm hiding. Like, what do I have to lose here? Like, I don't care about anybody else. I have my core set. And then from a wrestling perspective, I can help people who are feeling the same way that I was feeling. So maybe I could provide them hope, the hope that I didn't, or I thought I didn't have. So it was like a couples game night. For some reason, I just felt like the time was right. I picked up my phone. I typed up a little something on Facebook. I shut it off and, like, threw my phone across the room. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my parents. Didn't tell my friends. I wanted the decision to be mine and mine only. And then about 45 minutes in, I told Michael to pick up his phone and go on Facebook, because back then, relationships weren't official until it was Facebook official. So
right.
I sent him the relationship request. And I remember it. I'll never forget it. He picked up the phone. This huge smile came across his face. And then we read through all the stuff, which was, I'd say, about 99% positive, and, you know, cried and all that stuff. And it was a good moment. And that was kind of like phase one of coming out. And then part two was, I was approached maybe like a couple months later by this website called Outsports, which I had never heard of.
Outsports?
Outsports, yeah. They're an affiliate of the Huffington Post, which I had no idea. And they're like, hey, we'd like to write about your, I mean, would you like to write about your story? And I was like, well, sure. If one person reads it, you know, at least I helped.
Right.
Not thinking anything of it. So I wrote it up, sent it in, and I woke up the next day and my phone was just exploding because, you know, all the Huff posts around the world and all these other media outlets were just, it was going viral. And since then, my life has been, you know, forever changed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What a huge step to come out, right? And you mentioned, like, it's not something that you could just do brashly, but it must be a really kind of a big, like reveal, like almost like walking naked in public or something like that. Like, you really are bearing your soul. And the thing is, who really cares? But like you said, to you, you're, what if somebody does care? That must have taken a lot of guts to come to that point.
I wouldn't say guts. I think it was more or less, I was just tired of carrying this burden.
Yeah.
You know, it was more relief, I suppose, because I just wanted to live life without having to tailor my conversations and, like, hide from certain conversations that, you know, guys would typically be having, you know, with girls and stuff like that. And then I have to be like, yeah, I was hanging out with this chick the other night, and she was so hot. And, like, I was tired of doing that and tired of, like, hiding in the shadows, trying to, you know, live my life. So it was more of a relief, I suppose.
It's interesting. A friend of mine is Rob Halford. He's the singer of Judas Priest.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been on the show a couple of times, and he told the story about, like, in the 80s when he was a gay man but still closeted, he was the singer of heavy metal Judas Priest. And he was so worried that if he was outed that it would hurt the band, because it was such a macho heavy metal. So he would have to go in secret and, like you said, date guys in secret, actually even hanging out, like, in truck stops and that sort of, really kind of, it's amazing to think that that was only 30, 40 years ago, but how much things have changed to, like, where you said now in wrestling is also very macho style of entertainment as well, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Mm. It really wasn't, when you think about it. Even in the sense of, like, Fred coming out, that was like 2000.
Darren Young, Fred Rosser.
Yeah. 2012, 13. Yeah. I don't know the specific year, but that's not that long ago. Mm. You know, it's less than a decade. So a lot of stuff has happened very quickly, which is good.
It's very good, because also, too, I was very good friends with Chris Canyon, who never did. Well, he did finally come out, but we always knew that he was gay, and no one really cared, but no one really talked about it. Like, you know, we were all hanging out with chicks back in that time frame. He never did, but you could tell that he was gay. And I think that led to him having some real deep-rooted issues where he ended up taking his life, which is such a shame and so horrible. But is that one of the reasons why you wanted to come out too? Like you said, if one person reads this, do you consider yourself maybe not a role model, but are you kind of a lighthouse for other people that might be nervous in coming out? Have you ever dealt with anybody who said thank you, fans?
Oh, all the time. Fans, yeah. Other workers.
Like, really?
I get messages all the time, and they're all nice, because it affirms or confirms that I made the right decision. I spent a lot of times just legit, like, crying in my room. I remember just being so exhausted from it all. I pulled my car into my garage, and I just sat there for like 30 minutes in the dark crying to myself, because I was sick of constantly having anxiety, of constantly being scared of people finding out, scared for my future, you know, all those things. And there's a lot of thoughts that you tend to make up in your head, and you make it a lot worse than what it is. And then I'm lucky. I always say I'm lucky because I had a good support group with my friends and my parents, and other people don't have that, you know, that fortune. They have parents who are, like, super religious and they're against it. And then they have the fear of being, you know, excommunicated from their family. So there's so many different, like, layers to it, and it's all situational. Just to sum it up, it all sucks when you're going through it. Yeah. It just sucks. But I am, you know, 100% happy with my life now, because, you know, I'm comfortable. I'm in my own skin. And I'm just always free to kind of just be myself around people, which, you know, hopefully could be the case for everybody.
Yeah. And like you said, once you finally say it, like, who really cares in 2022, right? Like, really doesn't make a difference. Mm-mm. You know, one of my mentors in the business, and probably the guy who taught me the most about wrestling psychology, of course, is the great Pat Patterson. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I never met. Actually, it was like a hi and goodbye. I never got the opportunity to just
and
talk to him.
Completely gay, but his story too, once again, in the 60s and the 70s, with all the stuff he had to go through, especially in this wrestling business where it's all macho and fighting. Mm. And, you know, I learned a lot from him about, you know, about being a gay man in the wrestling business and some of the stories and stuff that he went through. But, you know, once again, like just how things have changed. But man, that guy was such a great performer. It's so smart. And oh, by the way, he's gay. Yeah. And nobody cared. Right?
Sure, sure.
So I'm sure that's a little bit inspirational for you.
Yeah. And I always hear a lot from your podcast, how good Pat was with, you know, his ideas and his finishes and his I guess, psychology with wrestling. So he was somebody I wish I was able to meet and kind of pick his brain a little bit.
Yeah. He was crazy too, because he was so self-deprecating humor about being gay. And if I told you half the jokes he told about himself, I'd probably get kicked off the air.
I feel that though, because I kind of do that myself, because it's almost a way of, you know, easing any kind. Because there's always, even to this day, no matter how long you're coming out, sometimes there's always this little thought in the back of your mind when you're with people who you may not be familiar with. You kind of want to ease the tension that you think might be there, so you crack a joke or something like that. So I understand that completely.
Since you've come out, has there ever been any issues at all since you came out of derogatory things?
So when we first started the YouTube channel, it was brutal.
You guys, Michael?
Yeah, Michael and I. Like and subscribe, by the way, Michael and Anthony.
Michael and Anthony, like and subscribe.
Quick plug.
I'll check it out.
We've grown the channel to about 215,000 subs. So
That's huge.
Yeah, yeah. We've grown a lot over the years, but we also get a lot of bad shit on there. Stuff that, like, you should never say to another human being, die, and all this kind of stuff. So that's where the majority of all the negativity came from. I've never had somebody come up to my face and say something, probably because I know I'll kill them.
You knock them off. No one's going to come to your face and say anything.
So right now. I'm lucky in that respect, but most of it has come online, and then we had that incident in Long Island. But
is that where it was?
Yeah, it was
during Dark or during
Dynamite?
Dynamite. You're wrestling the match.
You're wrestling a match. Apparently somebody yelled out a derogatory slur. I didn't hear it in the ring. I happened to see it in a
when
clip.
When you watch it back, it's pretty loud.
Yeah, it's pretty loud. And, you know, at this point, like, I became so numb to all this stuff early on, which I guess kind of was a big help for getting into the wrestling business and being on national TV, considering how negative a lot of people tend to be.
Yeah.
I'm just used to getting that stuff, so it just bounces right off me. And I'm used to ignoring it, but I kind of took that specific example to kind of show people that, hey, we still need a little bit more, you know, work to be done, because I don't really like to amplify any of that kind of like hate.
Negativity,
yeah.
Ignorance.
Ignorance.
You know, because, I mean, you're a pretty calm guy. You're a pretty, pretty quiet guy. But does it still surprise you that in this day and age, sorry, I know it's a little bit chilly in here. Does it surprise you in this day and age you still have people yelling out this stupid shit like that, and you know, it bugs me that you would yell at anything racist or homophobic or anything like that, but you're in the position actually of being in both situations.
It doesn't surprise me, because, you know, no matter how much you advocate, and no matter, you know, you can change 3 million people and turn them to better human beings, there's still going to be another million people out there who are going to be full of hatred and self-doubt. Like, there's always going to be those people. So no matter what, no matter all the good that you're doing, you got to be prepared and know that it's going to be out there.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So let's talk about your wrestling career, because, like you mentioned, that there's a lot of stuff that you've done. And more importantly, being a part of the Acclaimed. But let's talk, I don't know anything about your career prior to AEW. Where did you start? Where did you go? And how did you end up here?
So I was playing, I played baseball in college at Seton Hall and Montclair State University, and I stopped playing after 4 years. I had a fifth year of eligibility, which I declined. It just wore me out. It just wasn't fun anymore. And I kind of hit this place where I was so used to being on the field for 5-6 hours a day that there was this emptiness creatively and like athletically.
Right.
So I tried to look and figure out what would I want to do next. And I've always dreamed of being a pro wrestler, never thought I can become one. And I didn't know how to. And I went to the gym in Raw was in the area, and I went to the gym in, I think it was October of 2012. And I went there taking pictures with everybody. And the last person who I wasn't going to bother because he was working out was Santino Marella. And I was like, screw it. And my buddy was with me. He's like, you're never going to see this guy again. Just go take the picture. So I was like, okay. Took the picture with him. As I was walking away, he said, hey, you kind of look like a pro wrestler. Have you ever thought about becoming one? And I was like, well, coincidentally, yeah. I just don't know where to go or what to do. And he takes out his phone. He gives me the number to Pat Buck, who's currently a producer here at AEW. Called Pat. And then I went down the next week and I signed up.
Was that Creator Pro?
Creator Pro,
that's
New Jersey.
That's also Brian Myers' place too, right?
Yeah. So we have Creator Pro is in New Jersey in Rahway. And then there's Creator Pro New York, which is in Hicksville in Long Island.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I started training, and that's how I got into the business.
You remember your first match?
My first match was actually a battle royal where the main event was Tony Nese versus a student. Nese beat the shit out of him, and he was one of the students, beat the crap out of him, and then all the other students came out to make the save, and it turned into this big impromptu battle royal. So that was my first match, and I made the final four, so that was pretty good.
There you go.
Yeah.
You almost won. So when you're kind of bopping around the indies for a few years, did you ever go anywhere outside of the Northeast area?
So, I worked up and down the East Coast for a couple years. I was booked as an extra in 2015, and everything kind of springboarded from there. Like, I caught the eye of William Regal, and then he invited me down to a tryout at the Arnold Classic.
At the Arnold Classic?
Yeah. There was the first live tryout that NXT did. It was in front of the audience at the Arnold.
Oh, wow.
So that was the day What's-His-Face got fired.
Bill DeMott?
Bill DeMott,
Gotcha.
And Bloom took over. Did pretty well there, and then they invited me down to another one in September, which I did well. Physically, I did very well, but I blew. Promo was god awful, dude.
Okay, so let's tell us about this. So when you do these trials at first, especially when you go to the PC, there's like you're doing all the drills, the rolls, the barrel rolls. It's very physical, right?
Very physical, very tiring. It's almost deadly.
Yeah,
like you can't walk after.
And there's really nothing to do with wrestling. It's more just drills and drills and drills, right?
You're running the ropes. You're doing like drop down, jumping over bags. You're rolling for hours, yeah. And then when you think you're done, they bring you into the weight room, and then they kill you in there. Actually, funny story about that. Like, I watch, you know, I love wrestling, so I watch all the video packages and stuff, but I noticed that they always have one dude at these tryouts that they show on camera that just can't cut it. He's like on the floor, he's dying. Yeah, yeah. Just to show how brutal it is. And I'm like, right. I'm not gonna be that guy, you know, screw that. So I watched this video where they showed all the things, the drills that they were doing, like sleds and all that stuff. So I was like, I'm gonna practice all these things so I'm perfectly you know, okay with everything. So I did sleds at the gym every week, and I get down there and they're like, all right, now we're gonna do a sled race. So in my back of my head, I'm like, I'm gonna destroy everybody here, not taking into the count that I just did 7 hours of cardio and I'm like dehydrated and everything. So I'm like, okay, boom, go. I take off. I'm going a lot slower than I expected, and then I get down to the other side and my calf cramps up.
No.
And I fall straight down. I'm in so much pain, and they just happened to be filming for that show, Breaking Ground, that was on the network. I see all three cameras turn directly to me and sprint to me. And they're all like getting my face. I'm crying in pain. And if I think it's like the first or second episode in the intro, you see me on the floor just screaming in pain from my calf.
You were that guy.
I became the guy.
But you said you made it, because I know, see, it's funny because you think, how would they do that? But when I went to the Hart Brothers camp back in 1990, it was the same thing. They were trying to weed out the pretenders. Mm-hmm. Just that it was much more archaic. We had to run a mile backwards. We had to do 500 hack squats, which try and do 10 right now. I mean, we could do it, but anyone listening, try and do 10 hack squats, which is just stand there and go down and go back up. 500 of those, they'd stretch you out to where you were like you'd sit there in a cross leg position and they'd push your knees to the ground.
No.
Yeah, yeah. And all that was done just to weed out, you know, the guys that didn't really want to be there. So I kind of get that point of it, but it's pretty over the top. Like, no wrestler would have to do that here today.
Oh no, nothing that we did other than run the ropes and maybe like the rolls apply to any of the wrestling.
Yeah.
It's just strictly to kill you.
So tell me about your promo. You said you blew it in the promo.
So again, physically I did great, so I'm like, this is fantastic. And then on the third day they have you cut a promo and you sit in front of the entire room, you get all the coaches, and it's led by Coach Regal. And you know, when you know him, he's super sweet. But if you don't know him, he comes off as very, very intimidating. He's got these very fierce eyes that like look into your soul.
Yes.
So I got up there. The one thing he told me going into it was, he's like, you have got a lot of the tools that we need to make you a superstar. Just work on your promo and your personality. But don't cut promos like a wrestler. Just have a conversation. So that's what I practiced. And I cut the promo.
What did they tell you to cut the promo on?
It could be about anything.
Whatever.
I did something along the lines, like, I have scars over my legs from surgery, and I was like a model at the time. So it was kind of like an inspirational, like, you can, you know, you don't have to be this portrait of beauty to be a model. That kind of vibe. It was okay. And then he goes, all right, Anthony, can you do one more wrestler-like? And I was like, And at the time, I didn't really have a character. I was still in the closet, so there was this imaginary wall up that I couldn't like really get my personality out. So I was just this bland blue chip athlete with just nothing else. And I cut the worst, they probably have in the archives, I hope they burn it, the worst promo probably in the history of wrestling. I think I made fun of Bloom's voice. It was brutal. And I think that's what blew it for me back then. It was terrible. And then actually, when I got the email, it was the worst day of my life. I woke up that day. I got the email from them that said, not right now, but keep in touch. And then I went into the city because I was in such a abysmal mood, and I blew a casting that I had with Foot Locker. And then I came home, and then I found out my grandmother passed away, which, you know, she was like one of the most important people in my life. Mm. So it was just kind of like, it was the first day that life kind of kicked me in the balls. Mm. And it was also probably one of the biggest days of inspiration that I had, because I'm not one to kind of accept negativity too well. I like to spin everything to a positive. And I just kind of, I went crazy. I wanted to do everything I could to get better and one, prove them wrong, that they made a mistake, that they didn't sign me, and also to make my grandmother proud. So I started taking acting classes. I did improv classes. I did sketch comedy shows. We started the YouTube channel and grew that. I got an agent and I started doing commercials. I just wanted to do everything I could to kind of get my personality, mm-hmm. you know, out of that mm-hmm. gutter. And it worked.
You know, that's great, because it's interesting. You had called me a few months ago about an acting coach in LA, and I did that in 2005. I walked away from wrestling for a couple of years because I was just burnt out and I wanted to do other stuff. And I did improv and acting class, but improv with the Groundlings.
I was going to say Groundlings or UCB.
Yeah, Groundlings. Was really integral. If you look, when I came back in 2008 with the suit and tie guy, Jericho, and all the stuff since then, it really came from what I learned from improv comedy, which is always commit and just really drop into it. It's an acting technique as well, but
sure,
really made a difference for me also.
I found that and the YouTube channel helped the most.
Now, why did the YouTube channel help you so much?
Because you're always in front of a camera.
Gotcha.
And you're talking to nobody but that camera. So you're kind of forced to, you have to commit to your situation.
Right.
Or else it's super awkward because it's just a little phone there. And we have a catalog of hundreds of videos. So I had so much practice just trying to cut down on your takes. So you're kind of learning how to get things done very quickly and not have to worry about doing things over and over and over again. Learning how to speak properly and how to enunciate and how to, like, even doing something like this right now, I probably would have had a problem before the YouTube channel because I just couldn't talk freely. I would be so awkward about everything. Because I am outside, like, everyone sees me screaming and yelling and yelling, the Acclaimed have arrived and all that stuff. I'm a very loud person on camera, but off camera I tend to be a little introverted. I'm kind of quiet and shy. I'm not very much of a talker from a social perspective. I'm very much the guy hanging on the wall at a party or something like that, maybe until I get like a Long Island iced tea in me or something. But in that respect, it kind of brought me out of my shell.
No, and that's very important, like you said, to be in front of the camera and learn all that stuff. Because I always say wrestling is a lot like show business boot camp. You learn a little bit of every technique about show business. And if you can succeed in this business, you'll do really well in all their aspects, because you do have to do a little bit of everything here, you know? You mentioned acting and doing some commercials. Anything we might have seen you in?
So I did a commercial for Lunchables where I was a luchador that got beat up by the little animals. That was national. I did a,
that's awesome.
I just did one with Joe Mc, is it Joe McHale?
Yeah.
With Joel him McHale, yeah. On a first, is that Monkey Sour, something, Monkey Shoulder Whiskey. I did Domino's Pizza, did something for the NFL, Optimum Online, which is a cable company in the Northeast. Oh, wow. I did the Tough Enough commercials when they did the reboot of that. Probably missing a few others.
So you got a pretty good resume here of commercials that you've done.
Yeah.
And you still do that now as well. You said you just did one with Joel McHale?
Yeah, that was the most recent one. Now that Michael and I moved to LA, we're trying to, because you mentioned the acting class with Kirk. Actually, I have to email back. Thank you for reminding me.
Kirk Waltz, Marvin Nash from Reservoir Dogs. The cop who gets his ear cut off.
Yeah. Very interesting guy.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. So I want to start kind of diving into more like TV film stuff. I want to dip my toes in everything, mm-hmm. because I have a lot of creativity and a lot of different outlets I want to try and put that creativity into. But pro wrestling is, you know, it's always going to be number one.
So how did you end up here in AEW? Because you mentioned you had this tryout with WWE, didn't go. You kind of reinvented yourself with all this outside acting. And were you still wrestling, or did you take a break? Were you?
No, I was still wrestling.
Okay.
I was trying to pack my indies. I did a tour of England. I started to kind of branch out more from the Northeast. But in regards to AEW, so how that happened was, so following that tryout, I got the no, but just kind of keep in touch. By the way, if my voice is like shaky right now, everyone, it's because there's an air conditioner.
You can move your chair. I'm sorry. I came in this room and this place is freezing. So sorry, you're going to move out.
Oh, no, it's okay.
And the best part is this thermostat's probably from like 1965.
Oh, it's very
old. I tried
old.
To turn it up and I don't think it really worked very well. So,
All right.
Jericho's Meat Locker and Podcast. There you go.
So they said, no, not right now. And then randomly in 2017, I got an email, just one sentence, and it's, you're in line for a 2018 opportunity. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what that means.
From email, from WWE.
From WWE, yeah.
What a WWE word, opportunity.
I was like, I don't know what that means. There's nothing to expand upon. So I was just like, okay. And that was really about it. And then a couple months later, I was in the improv class. I got another email, and they're like, hey, we're looking to bring you in. They sent me all the stuff, the background checks and everything. I was like, oh, okay. Like, out of nowhere, I did it. I don't know what I did, but I did it.
You have no preamble to this. They just call you out of the blue and say,
out of the blue. Because every so often, I would email them just like updates. Like, hey, I'm doing this, or I'm working here now, or hey, check this out. My promo skills are getting better. But out of the blue, just got that. So I'm like, okay, I did it. Went through that whole process, was waiting on when they were going to, assign me a class and all that stuff. And then it just went radio silent. I didn't hear a thing. A couple months go by, like checking in with them, nothing. A couple more months go by. Then it became, the budget issue. There's no room at the PC. The excuses just kept coming. And it got to the point where it was like 2 years of this. And I was like, you know what? I got to stop worrying about this, because I was losing my enjoyment of wrestling. Because I felt like I started to wrestle to get signed as opposed to wrestling because I love it.
Right.
So I was like, screw this. I have to stop worrying about it. So I just stopped caring, started getting back to the love of pro wrestling, having really good matches with people. And then the pandemic hit. I was starting to pick up some buzz on the indies. And actually, that was around the time where Sean Spears was doing finding the perfect partner search.
Right.
And I get a message from Kevin Matthews, who's actually here today. He's like, hey, send this video in like right now to QT. Sent it in and ended up being in the top three for that. So I was like, okay, like this is going to be my opportunity with AEW. And then I hear that, oh, I'm going to be booked for the Blood and Guts show in Newark. So I was figuring that I was probably going to be his partner there. So I'm like, this is finally my opportunity. Like, I'm getting so close, and then the rug gets pulled away. And I get so close, and the rug gets pulled away. And in typical fashion, literally 30 minutes after the phone call, I go on Twitter, and it's like, every show's canceled. Like, this is a global pandemic. And I was just gutted. Like, I understood there was much more important things going on in the world, but it was like, again, I was
we were hoping
so
to get to Blood and Guts. Like, obviously, if we could just get to Blood and Guts, because we were supposed to have the double cage and everything. But like you said, it was 2 weeks prior, shut down.
Yep, everything's done. Yeah. So that was another blow. And then, you know, I kept in touch with QT. And I kept trying to come down. Then it was going to be June, but then the cases rose again. So that ended up getting canceled. And finally, I was just like, screw it. Like, I'll take my chances. I'll fly down there. I came down in October. I worked a dark against Lynn.
It's in Jacksonville when there's nobody there.
Yeah. Yeah. Jacksonville and empty Daly's place against Luther and Serpenico. Had a fun match. Actually, the night before that, I was a minute from going out, and they scrapped the match because someone got hurt. So it was like, again, like it went back to...
I can't even get a match in front of no people.
So I went to the hotel room that night and was just so defeated. But then I got that match the next day. And it aired 2 weeks later because, like, we were taping everything in advance. And about maybe 12 hours after that, the next morning, I get an email or message on Twitter from WWE. Hey, we want you to talk to Regal. I talked to Regal, and I hadn't heard anything from AEW, and I didn't really know who to contact in terms of anything. But then they offered me a deal. And
With WWE, with
NXT. And I said yes. I was like, all right, I did it. This is great. Somewhere along the lines, Tony found out about this and offered me to come down and meet him. They hadn't sent me a contract yet, so I was, and this was maybe like 2 or 3 weeks after I had said yes. So I was like, you know what? I wouldn't hurt to like hear this guy out to see what he said. So I flew down and
to Jacksonville.
And as I was going there, I get into the elevator and there's Max Caster. And I'm like, hey, Max, who I hadn't seen in a while. Like, Max trained in Creator Pro New York. I trained in Creator Pro New Jersey. We only knew each other maybe in passing, hi and goodbye. I think we worked each other once out of the years that we've known each other. But nothing like substantial. Right. I'm like, hey, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, I'm here to talk to Tony. I'm like, oh, well, I'm here to talk to Tony. And then we found out we were there to talk to Tony together. And we were trying to figure out what was happening. And then we get brought into TK's office. And he's like, hey, like, I have this idea for you two. I like you guys. I'd like you to call you guys the Acclaimed. And we're like, okay, that's awesome. But also at the same time, I was like, I just said yes to NXT. Like, it's a risk. Because if you don't like me, then this match airs. And then they see that I'm screwed.
Yeah.
And he was like, don't worry about it. Go out and have this match. We went out. We worked best friends. We had a great match. Came back through the curtain. I saw him give a thumbs up. And I wanted to be here in the first place. When the place first opened, my focus shifted here. I didn't really want to move to Orlando. And I also had this family emergency that happened that kind of changed my perspective. Like, I wanted to be home. I wanted to have more outlets of creativity to be able to continue my YouTube channel. Right. 'Cause I would have to give up everything.
Sure.
Drop that, leave my family, and go to Orlando. So,
yeah.
Like, everything was just telling me I needed to be here from the very beginning. And I put pen to paper, and here we are.
How was that for you to... because, first of all, I think I've told you this story before. I think at one point, Tony wanted to call the Inner Circle Chris Jericho and the Acclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted to be like Tom. As the example he used was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And I was like, I like the idea of a name, of a team name. But I know he loved the Acclaimed. And that's when I saw you guys, like, there's the Acclaimed. How was that for you? Because I just spoke to Daniel Garcia when Tony put him with Menard and Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the blue. And that night, the wrestling, Sting and Darby and Mox and whatever it was, kind of the same thing for you. This is your guy and you barely know him, but you better go out there and kill it.
Yeah, that was frightening.
Yeah.
It was from the time we had that conversation of us being the Acclaimed, and the match was maybe about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So Max and I are like, well, we don't know what the Acclaimed is.
You're right.
We don't know what to do, especially me, because I was doing this five-tool player character, which was like this top athlete, perfect combination of power, athleticism, intelligence, the look, and the it factor.
What was it called?
The five tool player. It's five a baseball term.
Gotcha.
For like a baseball superstar. I was doing that.
And what are the five tools?
Power, athleticism, intelligence, the look, and the it factor.
Gotcha.
And he's a rapper. Those two really don't mix. So we go out and we do this entrance, and it's terrible. I'll never watch this footage ever again. Cody told me, just go out and pretend that everything Max says is the greatest thing ever. Like, every diss is the most brutal diss you've ever heard in your entire life. That was the only direction we had. And I go out there, and he's rapping without music because we didn't have a theme. The Daily's place is empty. The boys are sitting up there watching, probably laughing their asses off at us. It was horrible. It was pretty terrible. But that became the issue because it's like we don't have a move set. We have to figure out like what we're doing. We need to figure out a look. We need to figure out color schemes. We need catchphrases. We need all of these things. And the reception to us because of all that, because we weren't this prepared package, was terrible. Like, everyone hated us. And not in like, you guys are like good heels, man. Like, we hate you. This, like, they wanted us to die. like, why are these guys here? Because like, we don't have a warehouse to train every single day.
We don't have house shows. We don't have to go house and try shows. Stuff. Yeah.
You know, we can't practice this stuff for 5 days a week for 6 months and then be this perfect presentation on television by the time fans see it. We had to learn all of that on TV or on dark every single week in front of people. We would just have to, you know, try moves and try new pieces of gear and figure out catchphrases that we don't get a response to because there's nobody in the audience. Like, the acclaimed have arrived line. Now everybody yells it because we have full arenas. But back then, you know, I'm screaming it to nobody. I sound awkward. And
it was almost shoehorned in because I feel bad is not the right term. But he comes out, Max, and he's just rapping and he's got all these lines. And you kind of like, you're the hype man. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, here's your one line.
Well, we needed. I didn't like, even have the line in the beginning.
You didn't?
No, because it would just end it and there would just be this awkwardness of like, he just said
what
that.
What he said,
yeah. So we had to figure out something for me to say, and I was driving home, my GPS was on, and it was like, you have arrived. And I was like, I'm in AEW now, I've arrived. They claim to have arrived, and that's kind of where that came from. It's not like the coolest thing to say, but if you say it with enough conviction enough, and you're screaming at the top of your lungs, you know, eventually.
But you've made it part of the act now.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. And people know what's going on, and they know it's the old, what did Billy Gunn used to say whenever he was at the Road Dog? We'd do the whole preamble, and then Billy would say, you know,
if you're not down
with that, I got two words for you. But that was kind of the whole thing that everyone was waiting to say, you know?
Yeah, I figured if I say something, you know, passionately enough, at some point it'll catch on, especially when people come back.
Mm-hmm.
And it has. You know, I'm signing it on 8x10s. People are yelling it in my face as I'm walking the Vegas Strip. So it's pretty cool.
Well, and the thing is, too, is you guys got put in some pretty big matches right out of the gate as soon as you got put together.
That was the other thing. I think we only had 10 matches together, and we were main eventing Dynamite with the Bucks for the title. So, like, Tony likes to get things going pretty fast.
But once again, I was going to say this, and I think I've read you saying this before, too. Tony is really – he's really good at a lot of things, but he's really good at putting together these interesting combinations of tag teams that really work. I mean, you mentioned Luther and Serpentico, and you know Griff and Pillman, and and then you guys. It's a perfect mix. But where did he see this from? You know what I mean? Like,
I have no idea, because Max and I we're great friends. Like, I talk to him every single day now. In the beginning, we were both kind of like, I don't know, because you know we're very much oil and water on some things.
Well, sure,
but we blend so well together in terms of almost everything. Like, and I think we've balanced each other out in a really, really good way. Like, in the beginning, he was very much extreme and I was very much super, super safe.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't take any chances. And he taught me how to, you know, be a little bit more, you know, adventurous with what we're doing out there. And then I, you know, kind of settled him into his role a little bit. So like we play off each other super well. We've rubbed off on each other well. And I think the product of, you know, what we're putting out every single week and people seem to really be enjoying, I think it shows.
But that was important too. Let's say you got put together and you don't like each other. Or one guy's an asshole or whatever. I mean, this is your career. This is your chance for both guys. You got to make this work no matter what. And it's good that you actually have some camaraderie between you.
Oh yeah, great camaraderie. Yeah. I can't imagine not talking to him at this point. You know, we're always bouncing. He's the one person that I know will be up at 4 a.m. when I have this crazy idea or the silly idea that we want to do. I know he's going to be up. I'll text him. We'll have a conversation about it. And plus, he's always down for like anything in the sense of, you know, we do all these funny music videos.
Right.
Which the last one we did was Godface that people really seem to like against Sting and a Darby. It's like, wouldn't it be funny if we did this? You're like, yeah, let's film it. I'm like, yeah. Okay, we'll film it. So it's really good to have a partner creatively like that who's just so down for everything.
One of the matches that you had early on was against me and MJF.
Yes.
Which is hilarious because I remember the match was really good, but there's one of my all-time favorite moments in the ring because we were taping these matches.
Oh man. Oh, not this.
Let's
story.
Talk about, okay, so let me I'll set the scene and then you can fill it in.
Okay,
so we're taping matches at this time frame because we did a live Wednesday night show, then Tuesday we would tape Dynamite, and I was watching these guys make mistakes and stop and start again. I was like, I'll never do that. I'll never stop. This is stupid. You got to be a pro out there. Fast forward to our match and tell us what happened.
Okay, there's actually another layer to this, which I don't think you know.
No, please tell me.
So there's a move that I do, which we actually still don't have a name for it. Max and I call it the special side slam. It's basically the kind of Uranagi sidewalk slam that I do before Max hits his mic drop on our finish. And I explained it to you, and you're like, yeah, I got it. So we're going through this match, and it's going great.
It really was.
It was.
Yeah,
really,
it was
really
killer,
fun.
Yeah,
and I was also, which I didn't tell anybody, going through very, very severe knee pain. I tore my meniscus in a match sometime in November. I didn't know it. I just felt knee pain.
Oh, like, wow.
I'd have to take breaks in the airport
really?
From walking, but I had just signed, so I was like, I can't. And we're getting pushed. Like, I can't.
Yeah.
Like, tell them my knees hurt in the middle of a push, like a month after I got signed.
Right.
So I was just sucking this thing up and just taping it up every single week and like giving Max most of these matches so I didn't have to do much on it. And it would be like, all right, it feels better. And then I'd have the match with the Bucks and then it was absolutely insane, killing me. And then it would feel better again. Like, you know what? I'll just wait one more match and then I'll get it looked at. One more match. And I was getting to the point, like, I need to get this looked at. But then our match came up. I'm like, I got to wrestle Chris Jericho and MJF. I got to go one more match. So I tape it up. We're doing the thing. I get tagged in for the hot tag. I think I hit you with a tackle and I take one step to punch MJF in the face and my knee goes. It pops.
Oh, shit.
So I'm in the middle of the comeback.
Oh, my god!
Bumping you guys. And I'm like I'm processing. I know it's taped, so I could stop in any moment, but I'm like, I can't stop. So I'm in pain. I'm going through this whole thing. And then it gets to the point where I'm just going to hit you with this move. So I go to pick you up, but your legs go the other way.
And the reason why I just fluffed it off is I thought it was a rock bottom. I thought you were giving me a rock bottom, which you pick the guy up and then your legs go out and then you come down on your back. And then, so when you went to give me the move, it didn't go right. And I was like, well, what happened there? That's weird. And so go ahead.
Yeah, so we do it once, and your legs go the wrong way, and I'm like, no, the other way. But I don't know if I said it loud enough. Then you did it again, but even further the wrong way. I'm like, oh, no.
Because I'm really trying to throw my legs out now. I'm like, I know I've taken 1,000 rock bottoms. I know how to do this.
I'm like, oh, no. And then I hear you go one more time. I'm like, okay. And then it was even more extreme in the wrong direction, and I kind of let you down. And then, Chris, I'm telling you, my heart sank down into my stomach. You shot up pissed. Junior, like, what's this move? I was like,
but then I realized one thing. I realized this kid is terrified. And then Max MJF tells a story where I just went, okay, please explain to me what I'm supposed to do. And I'll never forget the look on your face because you were like so like scared, like terrified.
I was frightened, but I'm also no-selling the fact that my knee is in excruciating pain.
I'm so sorry.
So I'm like, okay, my knee's in pain. This guy that I look up to hates me. I'm probably going to get fired tomorrow. I need to like hit this move. I explain it to you. We roll again. We hit it. The match goes off. Actually, I'm supposed to dive onto MJF after this. I do a house show and I jump up. And my knee, I couldn't get it up off the ground. So my toe hit the top rope and I nosedive first into the mat on the outside.
Oh, wow.
And by that point, I had just had it. I laid there and people were checking on me. I was like, I don't want to talk to you. I just want to go to the hospital.
Well, and you guys wouldn't even know this because I was always really involved in the edits of my match. And it was flawless. It looked amazing. But I remember that the fourth time I was like, okay, now I'm getting embarrassed because I got, what do we have, 20 people in the crowd.
Ringside,
but
yeah.
All these people are like, you know, there's some online that say, Chris Jericho, GOAT, Chris Jericho, this goes. I'm like, Chris Jericho doesn't know how to take a booth. I'm like, this sucks. I know it's not your fault. What am I doing wrong? And I remember it's like, can't yell. Can you please just tell me what we're supposed to do? And we did it. But then I remembered that dive because I was like, what happened there? And we had to zoom in on it and tighten it up or whatever it was. But
yeah.
Oh my gosh, I was laughing so hard. I went to Tony after, said it is not his fault. I had no idea what we were doing there. My apologies.
I feared for my job. I was like, these guys are going to think I suck. I'll never work here again.
Oh, no. That was all on me. That was all on me. So let's talk about, as we start to wind down here, because you mentioned that you work against the Young Bucks. There were some other big matches, and one of them was against Sting, who you said was the guy that got you into wrestling in the first place.
Yes.
How was that for you, kind of getting to that position where now you're wrestling one of your heroes?
Very cool. So I still haven't really soaked in everything yet, because I'm still, I guess, I'm always looking for what's the next thing and how we can continue to grow. So like, I appreciate it, but I guess it just doesn't really hit me. That was one of the nights where like everything hit me. That was the first match that I saw with him was the Sting and Hogan Starrcade, which was in Washington, D.C. That night, it was my 9th anniversary as a wrestler. We main evented Dynamite in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
And it was his first night back on TBS.
Oh, that's
cool. So it was a super cool, almost like life coming full circle moment. The match was great. He was super happy with it. It was really cool. I think the turning point for me, though, was the match with Danielson.
These are your single matches. Let me say this too. You went on a tear of your matches were excellent. Your singles matches were excellent stuff. Because also, too, when you're a tag team, and when one guy has to do singles sometimes, you're not as much in practice. But you can tell that you were probably wrestling singles for most of your career.
Yes.
I can't remember all the specific ones, but the Danielson one was good. Who else did you work with?
Jungle, Darby, Mox.
All those Mox was good. That was another good one. The Darby one was good. So
I feel like I was a bit underappreciated the first year here.
People didn't know you.
Yeah. I didn't really have the opportunity to kind of show what I can do because, you know, we have limited spots on TV, so we got to make the most of them. And a lot of the times it was, you know, very heavy on, you know, the rap. And then we're a heel tag team, so we're not going to be doing much cool stuff. That's not really the story of what we're doing. The story is, you know, these baby faces that have this program going on. So there wasn't really that much opportunity for me to show that, like, I've been a high caliber professional wrestler on the indies for a very, very long time as a singles wrestler. And I didn't really have the opportunity to show that or have any showcases, I guess, outside of just being a tag team. So Danielson apparently asked Tony to wrestle me, which I thought was cool and a really big moment for me in the sense that I think he's one of the best guys that do it in the world currently. And if he sees something enough in me to want to work with me, yeah, that's a big confidence boost. And went out there, we crushed it. And I think that was kind of where people were like, oh, like he's actually a really good pro wrestler. Mm. And I proved that. And then I had to prove to people that I'm also, you know, a fun personality. And that's kind of where I'm at now with in the wheelchair or what the wheelchair was.
Is this the same knee injury from before, the meniscus?
No, it's the other knee.
Okay, so you've been out for a while, but you're back now, but you're out for a bit.
Yes.
And once again, pro wrestling style, well, you know, sick in a wheelchair. You could have been in a wheelchair for a year. You're lucky that you're out by now.
Yeah, but I mean, it was my idea because I was coming out and people were like, why isn't Bones wrestling? Like, I felt like there should be a reason. A
story.
Yeah, some story behind it. And I also knew that, you know, we were building up to a pay-per-view, so it's not like we're going to have a ton of time to do things. So I figure if we have Wheelchair Bowens as a character with our new friends, the Gun Club, the Ass Boys, you know, we can really get across our personalities a lot more. So we can show that, you know, Max and I and all these other dudes are well-rounded mm-hmm. personalities. We're not just, hey, we're good wrestlers, or hey, this guy's a good wrestler, but this guy's a personality. Like, we're both entertaining sports entertainers, mm-hmm. like, as you would like to say, or pro wrestlers.
Five-point athletes, and that's another Tony visionary putting you with the Ass Boys, which has been a great connection with the four of you guys. And
actually,
Billy,
that was us.
Oh, get it?
Yeah. Everything that we've been doing is us. We saw the chemistry that we had together in terms of just talking, mm-hmm. you know, hanging around each other at the arena, and we figured it was an opportunity to really blend it together. We brought the idea to Tony. He gave us the thumbs up, which is, I think, one of the coolest things about being here, is we have a boss that trusts us but also knows when to put his foot down, whether it's getting a little bit crazy. But he trusts us to put together the pre-tapes that we're doing every single week, whether we're doing it on Dynamite or we're doing that, whatever you call it. We put together these little promos where we promote the next city, and they're super goofy.
Local promos. Yeah.
So he trusts us with that, and he trusts us with, like, Max and I with the music videos. You know, people always love those things. And actually, people started coming around on us after we did the Goth Phase music video, but we had been doing them for a long time.
Before every match that you had, pretty much.
Yeah, we would do it. Actually, I don't know if you saw it. We did a whole series on you and Max called Road to Kicking the Shit Out of the Inner Circle. We had a whole storyline. I brought my best friend in, Nico. He played a Gino Jericho, your Italian cousin from New Jersey, that you kicked out of the house because you're such a bad person. Like, we had all of these things that if it made TV, I feel like people probably would have came around.
That's the thing with our show. It's so jam-packed, it's hard to get that stuff on, but that's true character building. But we also have a big social media presence, so you got to just put it out there and keep it rolling, because it does make a difference.
Yeah, I'll show you that afterwards. You probably
okay. Yeah. I saw a couple of, I didn't see the Gino Jericho though one, but I remember you did a couple on us, because that was way back. When was that, November of 2020 or September, October?
It was earlier than that. I think that was in February of 2021.
So that's my point. It was a long time ago, you know. So last few things, and when you come out in the wheelchair, and I saw last week everyone's doing the scissor thing with their hands. is that what I think it is? What is that coming from?
Scissoring is simply a sign of friendship and nothing more.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
Yeah, get your mind out of the gutter, guys. That was another thing, like, organically, so a lot of things that people love about the Acclaimed have all been organic stuff, which is, I think, pretty cool too. There was one time in Dark where, you know, I hit my little pose where I put my hand down. It looks like the A. And then Max came up from behind. I think he had just to rib me, tried to catch me with the scissor.
Yeah.
And I reacted to it like, whoa, like, what are you doing? Because, like, again, like, in the beginning, I was super safe with things. Yeah. I wouldn't really, like, just yes and from an improv perspective.
Yeah. True improv.
I'd kind of be like, And they actually asked us to stop doing it for a little bit. And then I think Max milked my fingers once, which was even worse.
Yeah. Go so back to, like, the scissor.
So they're like, go back to the scissoring. But I was on the floor I can't remember what match it was, but I knew we were on to something when the entire front row had their hands out and they're all yelling, Bowens, scissor me. And then it just became a thing. And now we do meet and greet. We just did one last weekend where we signed for a good 4 or 5 hours straight, just constant line. Every single person wanted to scissor. They wanted a double scissor. They wanted a chain scissor. They wanted to do all kinds of scissoring. So it's a thing now. It's the new craze in pro wrestling. It's the new handshake.
That's the secret of wrestling, man. You know, like you mentioned, organically is the best way for anything in wrestling. When it happens organically, that's when you know it's got some steam behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So last few things for you. Now that you're back, you're healthy again, what's your goals in AEW?
First of all, tag team gold. I think we have more than what it takes to be at the top of this tag team division, to be holding the gold and carrying that weight for representing the company, I should say. That's probably our biggest goal. But I have so many different things. I like to take things one step at a time. I'd love to be TNT champion. Obviously, I'd love to be world champion at some point. But I just want to keep showing people that, you know, Anthony Bowens, the Acclaimed, we're fantastic performers. We're great sports entertainers. You know, we're superstars. And we want to keep getting that point across every single week and hope people have fun with us.
What's your favorite match you ever had?
Ooh. My favorite match.
Is there a few?
There could be a few, but actually, the most fun I ever had was with Kevin Matthews in this rinky-dink place in Brooklyn. I can't remember the name of it, but it looked like almost like a car garage type vibe, but it was super narrow, so there would only be fans on one side of the ring, and it would just go all the way back. Right. And the locker room downstairs was a dungeon, basically. There was just dirt and dust all over the place, and dirty, rusty tools. And for whatever reason that night, everybody was going crazy. They're like, I'm going to put you through this table. And Kevin and I were just like, let's just do the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And we had a comedy match, but it was so fun and so funny. He started off the match where he was loaded. Every part of his body was loaded with a pipe. It was like a hacksaw, a gimmick in there. We ended up having this thing where... Actually, Cornette would probably have a field day with this one. We all did each like superstars moves, but the surprise at the end was the ref started doing all of Punk's comeback on me, and then everybody was getting false finishes on each other, including the ref. The place was going crazy. The 70 people that were there.
Right.
That was probably the most fun.
Last question for you, going back to what we started with. Do you have any advice for anybody that might be gay, that maybe is scared to say something, or that is ashamed or embarrassed or anything along those lines?
Don't be ashamed of who you are. Be you. Come out when the time is right. Let that decision be yours. Don't let anybody else affect that decision. And know that there's hope, because there's people like myself, there's people like Sonny, and there's people like Nyla, and everybody else, whether it's here, another company, or on the indies. We're all trying to make the world a better place for you, trying to create more opportunities, more doors for you, so you're not that kid who's sitting at the desk crying hopelessly that you can't be what you want to be in life. So,
well, dude, you've done it, man. Awesome talking to you.
Thank you, Chris. This is fun.
Great stuff, dude.